from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn how proposed federal funding changes could affect job seekers in Milwaukee County. Then our latest Books and Beyond explores the resources available at the Wisconsin Talking Book and Braille Library.
One of my other favorite things, too, is that some people, like you said, do not know that they are eligible. They think we are just for blind people, and we are not.
Plus, we'll learn about a new art exhibit that explores what people can learn from birds in a new episode of Chirp Chat.
Birds teach us how to honor our body's intuitive wisdom. They fly thousands of miles into the unknown with no map. And our animal bodies have the same instincts to keep us and keep our flock safe.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. There are agencies in Milwaukee that help people find jobs. WUWM is turning to some of them to learn more about Milwaukee's job market and see how tariffs, cuts to federal government, and potential legislation could impact local job seekers. WUWM's Mayon Silver spoke with Julie Kao, interim CEO of Employ Milwaukee. That's Milwaukee County's Workforce Development Board.
First of all, just tell me a little bit about what Employ Milwaukee does. Who does it serve?
Employ Milwaukee is the Workforce Development Board serving Milwaukee County. We are the largest Workforce Development Board in Wisconsin, and there are 11 of them. We serve the most individuals, and we have the most funding. We have a dual mission, so we serve employers and job seekers through an $18 million budget annually.
Nice. Okay. So I actually met you at an Employ Milwaukee job fair. What kind of employers come to those and how often do they happen? Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Absolutely. One fact that people don't realize is that our board of directors is business-led. So a lot of the work we do is through a sector-based approach or industry partnerships. And that means employers tell us first, these are the jobs that are in demand. These are the skills that are needed. If you do these types of trainings, your job seekers will qualify and get hired by us. So that's always number one for us to do that process. And then we decide to have job fairs based on the quantity of job openings. So usually sector-based. So I believe the one that you had attended, Mayon, was a social services event. And so there were a lot of nonprofits, community-based organizations that had openings to fill. Other types of events we do are manufacturing hiring events, first source hiring events that are for construction, particularly for City of Milwaukee residents who can get a special certification and access to jobs on local projects that are funded partially by the city. We've also done hospitality job fairs, IT, financial services, really any industry that is growing, has good jobs with good wages and advancement opportunities, we'll set a hiring event for.
And when you say that right now in Milwaukee County, it's more of a job seekers market or an employers market?
I would say right now the unemployment rate generally is low. So we call that a tight labor market. And usually that favors the job seeker. That means employers need help. There's a lot of job openings. When you see a higher unemployment rate, that means employers are pulling back on jobs and there's more people searching for work. So right now in Milwaukee County, the official unemployment rate that was released in March of 2025 was 4.4%. And that is up a little bit from December of 2024, where it was 3.4%. But that doesn't tell the whole story in Milwaukee. So we have zip codes within the city and even in some suburbs that have higher unemployment rates. So if you dig into the data through the U.S. Census, you will see that, for example, 53206 has an unemployment rate of 12%. And that's just people searching for work and is not counting individuals that perhaps are incarcerated or have stopped searching and are long-term unemployed.
That's very telling. Those also are zip codes that are from marginalized communities, predominantly people of color. Employ Milwaukee knows this. What are some of the ways that you kind of target and try to bring services to those areas?
Yes, we have a robust community engagement team. So we don't wait for people to come to us at our corporate location. We do two things. We have satellite locations with pop-ups continuously. So if anybody goes to our website at employmilwaukee.org, there's a calendar and it will show you where the pop-ups are. So we go to the neighborhoods. We try to do a lot of place-based outreach and recruitment so that people really learn the services available to them. We also have service provider. So we are a funder of a lot of the organizations that people have heard about and do such good work. Examples are UNCOM, Milwaukee Christian Center, Journey House, Hispanic Collaborative, a lot of different organizations we actually contract with to provide funding to extend our reach even further.
And what are some of the things that you teach job seekers, or what are some of the basics that people should know about looking for a job?
Yes, job readiness training is another term for that is essential skills. So we always advise people to dress for an interview the way you would for work, and we teach people what that means, especially our youth programming. So we have an extensive summer youth employment program. A big part of that is introducing them to the world of work, what that means, how you need to dress and work with your coworkers. The second thing is to make sure if you have not obtained your high school diploma, that you work on that. That's always one of the first items that people will ask about, along with trying to get a driver's license if possible, and also to ensure your resume is up to date and includes the most recent work experience that you have. And we can help with all of those items. And if individuals do not have a strong work experience or background with a skills training program, we will enroll them in our programs and try to shore up those items on their resume and match them with a job seeker that has that type of role.
Well, that kind of leads into the what's happening in the federal government and those policies. Recently, the House, U.S. Congress, passed a bill that was sometimes being titled the Big Beautiful Bill by President Trump's administration that has a lot of his agenda in it, cutting a lot of Medicaid services, cutting some food share program. Like, how does a local job search agency like yours consider potential federal impacts on the people that live here?
Absolutely. We're watching our own funding, for one. So we have formula funding under the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. We call it WIOA. So that is discretionary funding, and that will be reviewed through the appropriations process this summer. So we are watching that closely because that's what funds our base programming that provides the training and the wraparound supportive services that I talked about to youth, adults, and people that who have been laid off from a job. So we are tracking that ourselves. We also have other discretionary grants that we are just ensuring that we spend well, meet our outcomes, so that they remain intact. But overall, as far as other social service programs being reduced, I think the impact is really that families will have more expenses potentially, but also their need for work is going to increase. So I have followed this a bit, and there will be work requirements possibly for some of the programs. That is a place where the Workforce Board, Employ Milwaukee, can help because we do have relationships with a lot of those providers and with employers, and we can help make that connection.
That's really interesting. Are there any places where you're worried, whether it's the DEI policies or other cuts that are happening through DOGE or anything like that, that you're specifically following and concerned about?
When the initial DOGE review happened, we were definitely concerned. We have 6 Department of Labor grants, 1 Economic Development Administration grant, the BioHealth Tech Hub, and then a lot of our other grants are sourced in federal funds. So we had identified that 98% of our funding ultimately is federal. So we were very concerned and watching it closely. Ultimately, all of those grants appear to have been reviewed. There is a new Secretary of the Department of Labor, and we've not received any terminations on our grants. As far as the executive orders surrounding DEI and other issues, there hasn't been further guidance issued from either the Department of Labor or the Department of Workforce Development that would impact what we do, meaning policy, procedures, things we'd have to change. So I'm assuming that if there are changes in those areas, it's just going to take a while. And now we have fewer federal employees to work on this also because a lot of individuals took the buyouts. So all of that executive order information flows through a process that turns into policy, that turns into procedures. So we're kind of waiting to see. But as far as normal day-to-day service delivery, none of that has impacted us, and we are business as usual.
And interestingly, in terms of the overall job market, NPR had reported on the May jobs report from a few weeks ago that the U.S. job market has cooled slightly as the Trump administration's trade war has heated up. There's just slightly fewer jobs in May than there were in April, but the drop was smaller than forecasters had expected. What are you watching for on that front in this economy? Are there any tariff policies affecting the industries that you work with?
I think it depends on the industry. We don't have a big automotive industry here, though we're probably in the supply chain. But a lot of the news has been around Detroit. So obviously they're impacted really directly by the tariff changes. I think it really depends on the industry, where they source their products, where they are in the supply chain. But overall, I believe that the administration's goal is to do more production in the United States. So for us, that means looking ahead to upskilling opportunities for current manufacturing workers, whether that's automation, robotics, AI, anything they need to have to stay competitive, and how to bring on new workers in case new locations are opened and, you know, new production occurs.
So I guess in closing, you've been, you know, helping job seekers and placing people with employers for about 30 years now. In the last year, what has been your placement numbers? Like, how are those statistics going?
Yes. In our last full program year, we served over 13,000 job seekers on a variety of levels and over 700 employers. So within that, we could simply sit down with somebody and look at their resume, give them tips on how to message their skills and get them right into a job, all the way through training them in occupational skills training that's industry recognized, putting them in a paid work experience, and then placing them. So the breadth of services is quite large, and again, it's individualized. So within that, we trained 1,600 people. Over 1,000 of those individuals were placed in employment, and the average wage was $19 an hour. So very successful within that. And we trend younger, so our youth programming is something that we're really known for, and we're starting the youth summer employment program season. So we have two programs, Camp Rise for 10 to 13-year-olds, and it's kind of a camp experience where they get career exploration speakers and mentors, and we pay them to attend. They get a stipend. And then the Earn and Learn program, which has been around for over 15 years, and we place up to 1,000 teenagers and young adults into 7-week work experiences with public and private sector employers. So through both of those programs, we're trending younger, and about 57% of our participants are youth.
All right. Thanks so much for sharing this information, Julie.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Mayan.
That was WUWM's Mayan Silver talking with Julie Kao, the interim CEO of Employ Milwaukee. This reporting is part of WUWM's commitment to cover the issues our community has told us are most important. We're devoting more coverage to three topics: climate change, immigration, and the economy. At WUWM.com, you can find more of our economy coverage. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Coming up later in the show, we'll talk to an artist who asked people to share their memories of birds as part of an exhibit at a local museum. But first, we'll learn about the Wisconsin Talking Book and Braille Library for the latest in our Books and Beyond series. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The library is more than just books, and our series with the Milwaukee Public Library called Books and Beyond showcases just that. We share resources, book recommendations, and some cool stuff you might not know about. Today, we're learning about the Wisconsin Talking Book and Braille Library, also known as WTBBL. It's headquartered in the Milwaukee Public Library's Central Branch. It's also part of the Library of Congress National Library Service for the Blind and Print Disabled Network. WTBBL provides audiobooks and brailled materials, not just to blind Wisconsinites, but also visually impaired, physically disabled, and reading disabled people, so everyone can have the access and power to read. To learn more about WTBBL, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski speaks with WTBBL Library Services Manager Beth Vokes and Outreach Librarian Katie Saldudi.
So to start, what is the Wisconsin Talking Book and Braille Library, and what's your overall history and mission?
So the Wisconsin Talking Book and Braille Library serves the patron base of the entire state of Wisconsin with low vision, blindness, physical handicaps that do not allow them to hold a book or sit up to read, and also our patrons with reading disabilities.
And when did this organization first start?
So we are part of the National Library Service for the Blind and Print Disabled, which is part of the Library of Congress. It started after World War I. Some veterans came back, obviously dealing with vision loss and blindness. And in 1931, so quite a few years after the end of the war, it got started with the Pratt-Smoot Act, providing accessible material for these veterans. It did not start in Wisconsin until 1961, although it was a nationwide program. Some of the regional locations started popping up years after it started officially for the National Library Service.
Yeah, I had no idea about that history, and that's a really interesting aspect. So how has your work and the outreach kind of changed from founding with a veteran population to now serving a broader population?
So over, this is before my time, but over the years, it has significantly changed. At first, it started with, of course, just blind veterans. Starting in the 50s, it also included children and also people with vision loss. And I can't quote the exact date when it started for people with physical handicaps, but as over time it broadened to include people with physical handicaps as well as people with learning disabilities. Additionally, and this actually is in my time, in 2021, there actually was a change in the ruling of who could certify applications for people with reading disabilities. Because prior to that, it was required to be a doctor's signature. And now the applications can be certified by a much broader range of people who work with people with reading disabilities, such as teachers, social workers, et cetera. So.
Okay. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about that? You mentioned an application process. So it's not just like, hey, come on, get our resources here. There's a little bit of a process compared to get a library card and check out any book you want, right? So how are you serving both individuals and institutions and putting them through those application processes?
Yeah, absolutely. So unlike the public library, our patrons do have to qualify to use the service. So as Beth mentioned, we do serve a specific part of the population and we do have an application. So our patrons do have to have a qualifying disability and have to be certified by a professional familiar with their conditions, such as a doctor, a nurse, social worker, etc. And part of the reason for that is because our material, the audiobooks and braille material, are copyright exempt. So unlike a traditional book you would find in the library, we have unlimited copies of the audiobooks. So when a patron uses our app, we have limitless copies available for another patron. They can also download it. They don't have to wait, which is great, but that does mean our patrons have to qualify. Okay. We can't just, hand that out to everyone.
Yeah, and the app you mentioned, it's called Bard, the Braille Audio Reading Download. And as you mentioned, those are readily accessible. There's no wait list. In what other ways do the materials you have differ from, say, what I would check out from the library upstairs?
So in addition to having the unlimited copies, our library has e-Braille. So we have Braille books that our patrons can download. We provide a refreshable Braille reader, which is, if you would picture, like, it's kind of a rectangle device, and it has a strip of little bumps that when you download a Braille book, they pop up with the Braille letters, which is not something you would find at most public libraries. We do also have hard copy Braille. We have audio magazines. We have audio described DVDs for our patrons to check out. We have kits, which is the Braille books as well as the audio. So we have a whole range of material that's more accessible for our patrons with vision loss or reading disabilities.
While we're on the technology note, so I imagine a lot of stuff has changed since it started its chapter here in 61. So how have those audio formats changed for you guys? And how do you continue to adapt for what your audiences need today?
Well, they did start off as records. So they were vinyl records, very, very fragile. A lot of them were broken. After that, then we had cassettes. And those lasted a really long time into my time, first time at Whittable. And then those evolved into digital cartridges. And after that happened, and we went to the Gutenberg model where we were able to duplicate on demand, all of those old ones that were just one set book went away. And we sent them all back to the National Library Service. And now you can still use those digital cartridges as well as BARD.
You mentioned your first time around. So what's some of your history with this organization here?
Sure. So back in the early aughts, I was the circulation supervisor. I was also doing a lot of duplication as well at that time for magazines and other circulation materials. And it was very different back then. I mean, we had thousands and thousands of cartridges that we went through every single day and mailed out. But that part has also remained the same. We send out things for free, and our books are able to come back through the mail for free for our patrons. So it doesn't cost them a dime.
I love that. And while we're talking about kind of the scale, can you both explain what your outreach work looks like and approximately how many people you're serving on a day-to-day basis?
Well, Katie does all of our outreach except for when she's unavailable, and then we do fill in. She does a lot of research, finds places that are, you know, working with people who are having vision issues as well as learning disabilities. And a lot of people reach out to us as well. They want us to come and give presentations to their residents. We come and give presentations on what we can offer them. And Katie gets a lot of requests for her to come out and explain our services.
Katie, what stands out to you about what's most important in your outreach work?
So honestly, I think what's most important in my outreach work, or most valuable to me, is connecting with the patrons who already use us, because they provide the best recommendations for our service. They talk us up so much, and they are the people who actually get us signed up with other people. And it's so fun to meet them. I so enjoy meeting the people who I talk to on the phone all the time. We have a book club, and it's been really fun to get to know some of the patrons by talking to them every month. And I love going around the state and promoting the service and getting new people signed up and hearing about how this has changed their lives, because it validates what you're doing.
Absolutely. Can either of you talk about some of the favorite aspects that you've experienced in this job and, you know, how it's helping to address misconceptions that people have had, or when you have that moment when you connect someone with a service who thought that accessibility was lesser for them?
I would say the most gratifying thing with our patrons is that they are always so thankful. When you're working in other aspects of the public library, a lot of the times you are getting nothing but complaints and upset patrons, and our patrons are always just giving us glowing reviews, making you feel like you actually are making a difference in their lives. And it's always so wonderful when you, like Katie was saying, that you get to meet these folks and they're just like, you know, my mother just cherished reading and she couldn't do it anymore. And you guys gave her a lifeline and an escape. One of my other favorite things, too, is that some people, like you said, do not know that they are eligible. They think we are just for blind people, and we are not. If you have low vision, you know, you can't hold a book. We're here for you. If your disability is temporary, you're just out, you got injured somehow and you can't hold a book, we will take care of you until that is done. Or if you have a permanent injury, we are also here for you.
Beth Folks is the Library Services Manager, and Katie Salduti is the Outreach Librarian for the Wisconsin Talking Book and Braille Library. They both joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski for our Books and Beyond series with the Milwaukee Public Library. To get in touch with WTBBL and find out more information or get connected with their services, you can call 414-286-3045. Or 1-800-242-822. At WUWM.com, you can explore all of our previous Books and Beyond stories. The Milwaukee Public Library is a financial supporter of WUWM. If you've ever waited for a movie at the Oriental Theater, you may have found yourself at Landmark Lanes for a game of pool, bowling, or Dance Dance Revolution. Landmark Lanes, also known as the Underground City, is almost 100 years old. When it was first created in 1927, it would have been hard to imagine how the East Side would evolve in the coming decades. Landmark was originally a part of the Oriental Theater and Oriental Drugs, eventually becoming a gathering place that generations of Milwaukeeans have come to know. As a longtime East Sider, Milwaukee Records' Matt Wild is a regular visitor to Landmark, so I met up with him there to learn more about this East Side institution. Matt Wild, thank you so much for joining me here at Landmark.
Well, thank you for having me, and it's I never really need an excuse to come here, but I'm happy to be here right now.
This is a place you actually end up going a fair amount, right? Your daughter likes it?
It really is, yeah. I live fairly close to here, so I find myself these days spending a fair amount of time here at the Landmark on the East Side with my 8-year-old daughter. And we go bowling, we play video games, and we just hang out. And yeah, we're here at least once a week, sometimes two times a week. So it's a hangout.
Now, for people who have never been to Landmark Lanes, and I admit there are probably few, but how would you describe it?
Well, I think it's interesting. In the last few years, there's been such a kind of a push for these so-called like activity bars. That's been a thing in the last 5, 6, 7 years. The thinking is people just don't want to go out anymore and sit and drink. They want to go out and do something else, whether that's throw axes or paint or play board games or whatever it is. And so there's been a lot of these kind of activity bars popping up in Milwaukee in the last few years. And they're great, but I find it funny because the Landmark in many ways is kind of like Milwaukee's original activity bar. It's been here obviously 95 years. And it's not just a bar. I mean, it's not even just one bar, it's three bars. It's not even three bars, it's three bars and a full bowling alley. It's a full bowling alley and an arcade. And of course you have all the, you know, foosball and darts and all the bar games like that. And on top of that, you have comedy, live comedy here from time to time, and you have live music from time to time. So it's just this kind of entertainment center. It's an activity bar before there were activity bars. So it's called the Underground City. It's definitely underground. It's a rather large basement facility down here. And when you kind of walk down the steps, it's like you're walking into a whole new world.
I think that might be one of the oddest things about Landmark. When you're walking past its
you know, like an entrance like any that you might see into a storefront. But the storefront in this case looks pretty small. It's really just kind of a doorway between a couple other storefronts. And then you walk down and it is a full bowling alley. But I mean, where we're sitting right now, it is just one of the bars. There are multiple bars down here. There's a number of pool tables. It's kind of like, I don't know, six places in one.
Yeah, I think Underground City is very apt, and they have that, you know, just a big sign that says this as you're walking down the steps. And you're right, it's like, you know, just one of these bars, the one we're in right now, I guess, is the Moon Room. And there's the front bar and the back bar, and each on their own would be a perfectly serviceable, perfectly lovely little neighborhood bar. But they're all piled on, you know, next to each other, and there's a kind of the bowling alley and the arcade, and it's all down here, and it's all kind of hidden, and I kind of like that. It's very apt. I think the Landmark is a place where I think a lot of people of a certain age have a lot of memories of this place, that coming here and kind of the heyday of like the 90s, 80s, 90s, maybe into the early aughts. And it's kind of a place that I think a lot of folks, as they get a little older, they kind of forget about it. And if I could be a landmark advocate here, I would be here to say that it's still here. I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon. It's still largely the same place that a lot of folks remember. For folks, again, of a certain age who remember this place during the time when we could smoke in bars, it does not smell like that anymore. I think that's one of the most enduring memories of the Landmark for certain people. Just remembering this place when you could smoke and having it packed wall to wall, all three bars, and every single person smoking all night long, and just a haze in here. And I was certainly in on kind of the latter years of that, and it was one of those things where you would just, you could be here an hour, make one or two beers, and you'd have to burn your clothes at the end of the night. I mean, they would just smell so bad. And so those days, thankfully, are long gone. It's not like that anymore. But in so many other ways, it's the Landmark you've always known and loved.
So you mentioned, of course, kind of the heydays of Landmark. What is some of the history of this space?
It kind of opened more or less in 1927. It was tied in with the Oriental Theater, which is right next door, of course. And before that, it was like a horse and mule and streetcar barn. So in 27, it kind of became a bar. And in 1972, I believe, it kind of became more or less the bar that we know now, the Oriental Lanes and Theater. And they changed it at that point into Oriental Landmark Lanes. That was kind of, you know, where things were for decades after that. And, you know, even if you look on the Landmark's website, it's funny, they do refer to the, like, 80s and 90s as their heyday. Like, just people down here packed wall to wall. It's changed hands in the last decade or so, but it's really remained the same. So it's been this kind of constant thing for so many decades. Even the sign that they recently changed and kind of updated outside, there was like an older sign kind of buried underneath the signs they were replacing that said Oriental Bowl, that dated back more than 50 years, 50, 60, maybe even 70 years. They weren't even sure. They covered it up again. So, but the new sign does look nice. So it's the real deal. It's just kind of been this thing forever.
There's a brand new sign outside. What I found interesting about this brand new sign, looking at both the sign they replaced and the sign underneath it, remarkably little has changed.
That's right, yeah. You know, people are scared of change. People don't want change. But, you know, looking at it, it was like, sure, this new sign could have been made in the 70s or 80s. It's retro without being, I think, obnoxiously retro. So I think it's very fitting. They did a fine job with it, and I think everyone will just instantly get used to it in about, oh, I don't know, 10 minutes. So, very fitting.
A continuation of an institution, now that you said.
Absolutely, and that's what this place, I think, really is. And like I was saying before, it's a place that I think a lot of people have fond memories of when they lived on the East Side, and maybe in the years since, they've moved on to other neighborhoods. They've moved out to Bayview, or even farther flung than that. Some have gone way out to the suburbs, but The East Side, I moved here way back in 1996. I've been here ever since. I've never left the East Side. I've kind of just bounced around in a small radius from apartment building to apartment building. And it's really reassuring that this place and this neighborhood kind of sure has seen some change, but the landmark is still here. And it's something that, you know, people need to be reminded of sometimes. Maybe they haven't been to the side of town in a long time, and I am here to say that welcome. Welcome back to the East Side. It's there's a lot of things that are different, but one thing that is not different is the landmark, and it's, you know, in my view, lovelier than ever.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for joining me here at Landmark.
Absolutely. Thanks, Ed.
Matt Wild is a co-founder of Milwaukee Record and a longtime fan of Landmark Lanes. We recorded this interview at Landmark in 2022 when the East Side Institution was celebrating its 95th anniversary. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break, and then Chirp Chat explores a new exhibit at the Charles Alice Museum called Bird Body. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Think about the last time you noticed a bird. Was it flying away from a predator? Or maybe it was building a nest? Bird Body is a new exhibit at the Charles Alice Museum in Milwaukee that explores what people can learn about themselves by observing the birds around them. Hattie Grimm is the artist in residence at the Art Museum and the creator of the exhibit. For this month's Chirp Chat, Grimm joins Lake Effect's Excret Nunez to talk about her inspiration for Bird Body and how it engages visitors.
For today's episode of Chirp Chat, I thought it'd be interesting to explore what birds represent in people's lives. And Hattie, your art exhibition features 20 original wooden paintings and sculptures. What inspired you to create this collection of artwork?
Yeah, so I formed a relationship with birds when I was going through a hard time. And to cope with that, I started going to the lake every morning. For just 10 minutes, I would stand there, and that early in the morning at sunrise, really nobody else is there except for the birds. And so I got to see mergansers and grebes and red-winged blackbirds. And one time I saw a pelican, and I got to see them swim and hunt and sing. So naturally, birds became a really relevant symbol in my artwork. Birds teach us how to honor our body's intuitive wisdom. They fly thousands of miles into the unknown with no map, trusting in their instincts to lead them and their flock to safety. And our animal bodies have the same instincts to keep us and keep our flock safe. So I'm really inspired by my own journey of trying to tap into my own body's communication and honor it when I need rest, when I need to grieve, when I need to celebrate. Unfortunately, we have inherited a culture that expects us to ignore or avoid this communication, ignore our desires, our bodily needs, our emotions in favor of productivity, in favor of what someone with more power tells us we should be doing. So I think it's a really important part of becoming more free and more ourselves to tap back into what our body knows about keeping us safe and keeping us happy.
And do you feel like birds have always played some sort of role in your life, or is it something that you just started taking notice of during this time in your life?
They really came to me more in the past couple years during that difficult time. the lake has always been something really important to me and something that's really calming for me. And so that was kind of my initial entry into taking care of myself and just spending time at the lake. I ended up spending a lot of time with the birds.
And I noticed your paintings and sculptures aren't the reflection of a particular bird species. Can you describe your artwork to our listeners so they have an idea?
Yeah, so my paintings and my sculptures are not representative of any specific species of bird. They're more just a representation of birds as a symbol of freedom and intuition. So the birds are really a representation of my body, of me as a bird. So some of them are bird-human hybrids. Some are flying, hanging on the wall. Some are standing. Some of the sculptures are small and could fit in the palm of my hand. And the biggest one is bigger than me. It's 6 feet by 4 feet. So the sculptures are made out of reclaimed wood that I cut with my jigsaw. They're painted with really bright colors like watery blues and yellow, and one of them is hot pink. And inside of the bird and human bodies are swirls and waves and squiggles and words and pictures to represent the communication that I want to honor that I feel in my body.
Yeah, and I noticed that another important element of your art exhibition is that it's interactive and encourages people to be curious and reflect on the role birds play in their lives. Why did you decide to do this?
So there are two interactive activities in the show. One is that people are encouraged to draw their own bird, and the other is that you can tell your own bird story. Creating rituals for people to participate in my work is really essential to my philosophy about my artwork. As a former teacher, it's really important for people to be able to engage with my work so that I can show them what I'm talking about rather than just tell them. So the activities are meant for people to feel a sense of play, a connection to the birds in their environment, a connection to their authentic creative self in a way that there's no stakes, no judgment, no pressure.
And you recently had a bird parade. Can you tell me about it?
Yeah, so the bird parade involves a giant bird puppet that I built. It takes 4 people to carry it. And myself and my collaborator, Haley Fuhrer, developed a intention-setting workshop that is themed around collective liberation and birds as a symbol of freedom. So the workshop involves yoga and meditation and journaling and funneling those things into an intention of what people feel capable of and want to contribute to the cause of their community and collective liberation. So we write the intentions down on fabric feathers, we attach the feathers to the giant bird, and then we parade the bird around whatever environment we're in with music and streamers and twirlers and egg shakers. And it's a really beautiful celebration to feel connected to one another, connected to the natural world, connected to ourselves.
I love that. And I could understand how I would feel even more connected to the environment that we're in when we're sharing that space. In general, I guess, what do you hope people come away with after seeing your artwork?
I hope that people can just offer themselves a moment to tune into their own bodies and emotions and just give themselves a moment to move away from a state of frozen panic or overwhelm that we can find ourselves in and more into a flow in feeling feelings and expressing ourselves and connecting with others. Invite them to be thoughtful about the small beauties in birds and their lives and just be appreciative of the life that we have on Earth and the world around us.
Absolutely. And before we wrap up, at the end of every Chirp Chat, I love for guests to shine a spotlight on a bird for the month. So Hattie, I'm wondering, what's a bird you'd like to highlight this month?
Well, I know that we have this bird in common, but I want to highlight mourning doves this month. Mourning doves are a type of dove. They're grayish brown, and they like to hang out up high on power lines or up in trees, but I've also seen them walking around the ground in my alley. But I picked them because I find their cooing to be really comforting, how slow and low it is. It almost feels like a sound that I can make, that I can relate to. but I've been especially noticing them lately since my beloved dog Teddy passed away, and spending time around a mourning dove feels kind of like spending time with him, just sitting and watching and appreciating the day, having nowhere to be, not rushed, just sitting up on the wire, enjoying the sunshine.
Oh my God, Hattie, I'm gonna cry.
Oh, me too.
So sweet.
I know. Yeah, mourning doves are special.
Hattie, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really enjoyed learning more about your artwork and reflecting on what birds can teach us. This was really fun.
Thank you so much, X-Grad. I had a lovely time, and yeah, I love birds.
Hattie Grimm is the artist in residence at the Charles Alice Art Museum. She spoke with Lake Effect's X-Grit Nunez about her exhibit, Bird Body, for a monthly series we call Chirp Chat. You can visit Grimm's exhibit at the Charles Alice Art Museum through September 25th. Now we'll hear an audio collage of people sharing their bird memories, which they recorded at Grimm's exhibit.
My favorite bird memory is the fact that my uncle, who passed away in February 2025, appears to us every morning as a cardinal. So when I sit out on my front porch with my morning coffee, every day without fail, he comes down to our bird feeder, says hello, and watches over us.
When my friend Stevie passed away from cancer, his favorite color was blue. And that morning when I was thinking of him and writing something to say, I got a peck at the window in front of my desk, and I looked up, and it was a blue jay just looking at me, and that was his visit. That's my bird story.
I bought my pet bird Basil from a pet store, which I normally don't like to do, but after 3 months of having him follow me in his glass case as I walk past, I thought, this is my bird, and I bought him, and we bonded immediately. And we had struggles when he had prepubescent hormones kicking in. We got into a fight, and it left me with 21 bloody wounds at the end of the week after trying to rebond with him and retrain him. It worked, though, and now we have just the best relationship. He's just my little buddy. He's my little dinosaur. He's my little dancing partner. He loves bad pop music. So it's amazing how the mammal and dinosaur souls can connect, even though historically they've been enemies in the tale of evolution.
When I was in middle school, I went to the pet store one day with my cousins, and there was a lone lovebird in a cage at the store. And I asked my mom if I could get it, and she said yes, and I named him Lovey. And he was the most beautiful bird I'd ever seen. He was small and green with a little bit of orange around his face. And he would sit on my shoulder while I did homework and hang out in my room and chill on my computer desk while I web chatted with my friends. And one day he just died, and I had no idea why. And then I Googled lovebirds, and they actually are supposed to be living in pairs. That's why they're called lovebirds. They die if they're alone. And it was one of the saddest memories of my childhood, because I thought my love maybe should have been enough for him, and it wasn't. I think it taught me that, you know, there are some things in nature that we just don't understand. Anyway, R.I.P. Lovey.
I've moved around a lot, and for a few years I was living in Austin, Texas, and just being really sad that there is no high ground. It's so flat, they call it hill country, they're full of liars. However, there's a beautiful, beautiful piece of land called Raymer's Ranch that my friends and I would go out climbing in, and I always got to the top of the wall and just sat there because it's a beautiful view, it's cool in the shade, Texas summer, it was a very precious thing. And I look around, and maybe 5 feet away, it's just a turkey vulture, just one of the largest birds I've ever seen in my life, just looking at me and probably wondering why I'm up in the trees with it, but I just said hi and waved a little out of nerves and quietly requested to be lowered out of the trees and decided to observe it from a relatively safe distance of the 40-ish feet below. Properly, I think that day I was okay not sharing the trees with the turkey vulture, but I can say I have done it.
Those were voice recordings from people who visited Hattie Grimm's exhibit called Bird Body, now on display at the Charles Alice Museum. You can listen to more episodes of Chirp Chat at WUWM.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll speak with a local animal attorney about what animal law entails and the types of cases he takes on. Plus, comedian Matt Walsh will talk about the art of improv ahead of his performance with Bluebird Improv in Milwaukee. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.